Our third case for argument this morning is Cuff v. Transstate Holdings.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is David Hayes and I'm counsel for all.
So I will call you when we are ready to go.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I want both sides to sit down.
I apologize.
Mr. Hayes.
All right. Once again, good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm David Hayes. I represent all the defendants in this matter. To start out with this case, it's very important to look at the totality of the circumstances. I almost want to characterize it as a 10,000-foot flyover since we're in an airline case. You have a senior manager of 25-plus years with an unblemished record, no evidence of bias, no nothing. Has an employee approach him and says, I want an FMLA leave. He's handled hundreds of FMLA leaves. He believes that the employee is not eligible for leave, so he does what he has always done. He consults learned counsel at the company about the request for leave. Is this employee eligible for the leave? Decision is made that there are not 50 employees within 75 miles of the work location. Straight line, count the employees, put a circle around Chicago O'Hare, there aren't 50 employees. He denies him the FMLA, but goes ahead and grants him additional time off through the holidays, the worst possible time to be away from the facilities at O'Hare, but nevertheless grants him that time. The end of that additional grant, plaintiff fails to reappear, he's separated from employment, and this action follows. This action is based on a very novel legal theory that has not, as far as I can find, been found to be supported in any circuit in the United States, contrary to decisions of the National Mediation Board, which I'll talk about in just a minute. You take the employer, Transstate Airlines, and you go up to its holding company, Transstate Holdings, and then you attach to a whole other airline, GoJet Airlines, and suddenly you come up with your 50 employees. At the time in question, Mr. Cuff, the plaintiff, worked for Transstate Airlines, which had approximately 30 employees in Chicago, not be eligible. Transstate Holdings, at the initial time of this, had zero employees. It's not even registered to do business in Illinois. It's simply the parent company. GoJet Airlines, a separate subsidiary of Transstate Holdings, had hundreds of employees. But that should be completely irrelevant because in this case, a decision had already been rendered several years prior by the National Mediation Board, which is not directly on point as to the FMLA claim, but the analysis is exactly the same, that GoJet Airlines and Transstate Airlines are not a single entity for the purposes of employment relations.
I say, counsel, I don't follow this line of argument. If I understand the plaintiff correctly, the plaintiff is saying that although many other employees, like pilots, were employed by one carrier or the other exclusively, that he was employed by both, that he performed services for both. And under the Department of Labor's regulations, that is a separate ground for aggregating the employment pools of the two employers. I think you need to concentrate on that possibility.
Well, I appreciate it, Your Honor, and I will. The reason what I was trying to outline, we believe, is so important is because we're here on an appeal from a summary judgment. There was no facts. The opportunity to present evidence, for example, that Mr. Cuff only worked for Transstate Airlines, that his own tax return. I'm sorry?
You had a perfect opportunity to present evidence. The question is whether there was a material dispute about the fact whether Cuff worked for one airline or two airlines.
Well, yes, Your Honor, but I mean, we didn't get to explore the facts at length.
This is a question about the summary judgment standard. Is there a material dispute in the existing record on that question, or isn't there?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe there is.
Now explain to me why there is a material dispute of fact on that question.
Well, for example, the joint employer analysis that's relied on to put GoJet and Transstate Airlines together, talks about that you have to look at the entire relationship is to be viewed in its totality.
Explain to me what the material dispute of fact is.
Whether Mr. Cuff ever worked for GoJet Airlines.
That's the bottom line. Tell me what the dispute of fact is. not what the legal conclusion drawn from the facts is, but what the disputed factual questions are.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, I don't know where to start. We dispute almost all of their facts.
Let me just cut through this. TSA and GoJet are national U.S. carriers that operate under United Express. True?
Yes, ma'am.
They're wholly owned subsidiaries of THS?
Trans-States Holdings, TSA,
right.
Yes.
And the defendants, THS, TSH, TSA, and GoJet physically shared corporate headquarters in St. Louis, Missouri?
Yes, they do.
They filed single tax returns with IRS under a single tax ID number?
It's a privately held corporation, and yet ultimately it files a single tax return.
So the answer is yes. They filed. They had common integrated corporate departments that performed the same functions. For example, Rick Leach and Jerry Wigmore were president and vice president and CFO for all three defendants.
Well, the second part is correct, Your Honor. The commonality question, we do not agree with that.
But this, let me ask you this. The title, Rick Leach and Jerry Wigmore were president and vice president and CFO for all three defendants.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And Basham, TSH's vice president of customer service, and Trowbridge, the managing director of customer and ground services, each supervised employees at TSH, TSA, and GoJet. True?
I don't believe that's true as to Trowbridge. It is certainly true as to Basham.
And you allege that in the summary judgment motion, you had an affidavit that disputed that one fact?
I don't recall if we did, Your Honor.
Okay, so if you didn't, you lose on that, too. Employees were also regularly and casually transferred between THS and TSA and GoJet?
We could not dispute that more. In fact, the National Mediation Board found that that was absolutely untrue in their previous analysis of the relationship.
And that's evidence that you submitted to the district court?
Yes, Your Honor.
So that's your only material dispute?
Well, but, Your Honor, we're relying on well-settled decision by the agency that makes this decision exclusively, whether these are single carriers for the purposes of employment relationships.
So you're saying the district court couldn't make an independent determination of that?
We certainly
examine what had been submitted? For purposes of summary judgment?
We believe the court certainly could have. We believe they did not. We did not get a full and fair opportunity to exhaustively go through the facts that would clearly demonstrate we were separate carriers.
So the district court wouldn't allow you to provide affidavits that set out your position?
Well, I wouldn't say they wouldn't allow us, Your Honor. I mean, we just never got there. I mean, the Honorable Judge,
yeah. There's some
the Honorable Judge only allowed us to have a trial on the issue of damages.
No, look, there's a motion for summary judgment. That is the put-up or shut-up time. If you don't file evidence, you lose. That's perfectly straightforward. In what sense did the district court not allow you to submit evidence in response to the motion for summary judgment?
Well, I mean, I guess, Your Honor, I wouldn't say they didn't allow us. I mean, it's obviously a decision.
But that's what you just said. You said the district judge didn't allow us to submit evidence.
Well, I certainly meant that at trial, Your Honor. Prior to that, certainly we could have submitted anything we wanted with our summary judgment motion.
Yeah.
And we believe we submitted more than enough factual disputed evidence to lead this to trial rather than a motion for the granting of their motion on summary judgment. There's just too many disputed facts. In fact, looking at that analysis itself, the Moldenhauser from this court talked about several of the issues that we raised, and the whole issue of hiring and firing, the dispute just raised by Her Honor about whether people casually transferred. There's no evidence of that in the record other than the mere supposition by plaintiff's counsel. In fact, all the corporate formalities were maintained at that time. The district court judge in his decision even said that there was an implicit arrangement between the defendants to share his services, referring to plaintiff. How we could get to an implicit arrangement with no facts being presented in evidence.
And then you cited Moldenhauer, and you're right. There are four factors they identify: the power to hire and fire, to supervise and control work schedules, determine the rate. But the court also said the court never formally adopted any test and said that although the four factors are relevant in deciding whether an employer-employee relationship is there, so it would be foolhardy to suggest that they are the only relevant factors or even the most important, and said the ultimate determination depends on the specific facts in each case, and the court has to look at the totality of the circumstances to determine whether two employers are joint employers. You don't dispute that's what the case says.
No, Your Honor, we don't. But there was a full and fair investigation of this by the National Mediation Board, who had hearings and witnesses interviewed and brought in people and decided GoJet and TransStates were not a single carrier. If this court upholds the decision going forward, it's going to fundamentally change a decision of the National Mediation Board. Wow. The other TransState, well, because the other TransState Airlines employees.
Look, trying to talk over a judge's question is not a good strategy.
I apologize, sir.
If the rationale for the district court's decision and our affirmance is that this plaintiff in particular performed work for both TSA and GoJet, how does that affect or contradict anything the National Mediation Board said?
Because I believe, Your Honor, it would require TransStates Airlines to then provide all its other 33 Railway Labor Act airline mechanics with FMLA benefits in Chicago, even though there aren't 50 employees. Because if Mr. Cuff was entitled to it, why wouldn't the other TransStates employees at Chicago be entitled to it?
The other employees worked for both TSA and GoJet.
Well, but that's the ultimate dispute. They work on GoJet airplanes, but they are full-time employees of TransStates Airlines. As my time grows short, Your Honor, moving on very briefly, in terms of the evidence that was related at trial, we believe in the damages phase of this case that the judge erred in not allowing us to present evidence regarding the plaintiff's alleged drug abuse and his sexual relationship with a subordinate. The reason we believe that that was very important is because had the jury understood, as we believe we would have been able to present evidence, that he would not have been able to return to work because he would have failed the mandatory...
What did your offer of proof say? There seems to be some dispute between your brief and the appellee's brief about what evidence you wanted to introduce. So presumably you clarified that in an offer of proof. What did the offer of proof say?
I believe it was the records from the doctor about the belief that he was abusing otherwise lawfully available prescription drugs.
That's not the thing on which you needed to make an offer of proof. You needed to make an offer of proof about how this would have been detected and what the company's response would have been. And presumably you do that with statements of responsible officials. But I'm just looking for the offer of proof. The rule of evidence says you cannot complain about an order excluding evidence unless an offer of proof was made. And I must say I've looked for the offer of proof and I can't find it. Am I missing something?
I don't believe you are, Your Honor. I'm at a loss to explain that standing right here. I hadn't thought that through.
Without an offer of proof, you just can't complain about the order excluding evidence. This is really fundamental to litigation.
Well, we raised the issue at the damages phase, Your Honor.
We raised the issue, that's fine. The rules of evidence tell litigants what they have to do to preserve an issue for appellate resolution. And that step is an offer of proof.
Thank you, Your Honor. Lastly, as I said, as my time grows very short, our last issue on appeal is the fee issue. Jury awarded Mr. Cuff $28,800. In the end, plaintiffs want to be awarded more than 11 times that number in attorney's fees. Even if you take the total final judgment of the case of nearly $50,000, they want to be awarded nearly seven times that in attorney's fees. It's grossly out of proportion, and under Moriarty, the court should pay special attention to fees that are highly disproportionate to the outcome of the case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hayes. Mr. Caffarelli.
May it please the court. Good morning. There are three issues on appeal here, the first being the joint employer issue, the second being the evidentiary issue, and the third being the fee issue. I'll address them in that order. Judge Leinenweber, in a 29-page opinion, found on summary judgment that the three defendants were joint employers of Mr. Cuff. And we agree that the inquiry under Moldenhauer is a totality of the circumstances, and further under the regulations, that it's a totality of the circumstances as they relate to Mr. Cuff in particular. So it's an individualized inquiry that we're conducting. I believe, based upon the court's questions, that you know a little bit about how this, how the defendants operate. They're the United Express flights, the regional flights out of O'Hare. If you ever go to Terminal 1 and see the planes, they're all painted with the same logos, whether they're GoJet or TSA. Holdings is the holdings company, and to an outside observer, other than the types of planes that they fly, TSA flies one type of plane and GoJet flies the other type of plane, there's no difference to that outside observer as to between TSA and GoJet. It's simply a United Express plane. Mr. Cuff was a regional manager for all United Express flights out of O'Hare. His job description is silent as to the employer, and it's undisputed that everything listed in that job description he did on behalf of both TSA and GoJet. If a passenger, for example, or the U.S. Department of Homeland Security or United itself were to contact GoJet and say, we want to speak to a manager, Darren Cuff would have been one of those managers that they would have ultimately spoken to. Mr. Cuff was interviewed, hired by, and supervised by Terry Basham, who's the Vice President of Customer Service at Transstates Holdings, as well as, counsel admitted, also an executive at both TSA and GoJet. Mr. Basham admitted in his 30B6 deposition that Darren Cuff's job was to handle all United Express operations at O'Hare for both TSA and GoJet. And since I'm on that topic, the evidence that Mr. Cuff relied upon on summary judgment was all based upon admissions by the company, either Mr. Basham's 30B6 deposition on behalf of Transstates Holdings or documents, uncontroverted documents. For example, Mr. Cuff is given a business card immediately upon hire with the logos of all three corporate defendants. He's listed in all internal corporate directories as the person in charge of both TSA and GoJet at O'Hare Airport, in addition to the other airports in his region. Throughout his employment, he receives daily assignments from management at both TSA and GoJet. He has access to the computer networks of both TSA and GoJet, and he's designated as the local contact in emails from his supervisor to the Department of Homeland Security as well as United Airlines. And in those emails, he's actually referred to as a Transstates Holdings employee. As far as how these defendants are run, everything is centralized. So as the court has noted, all three entities are privately owned by the same person and have the same president. They all share a single tax return with the same federal tax ID number. They share their headquarters in St. Louis. They share some corporate departments. They may not share all of the corporate departments, and that's in the record. We actually flew down to St. Louis and did an inspection of the facility, and if you have nothing to do on one day, I'm sure you don't. You always do, but you can look at that video, and clearly we walk through the entire facility and identify the shared departments and the departments that are not shared. All three entities, as we've mentioned, share members of upper management. The only material difference, again, that between these entities are the types of planes that they fly and the pilots that fly them, and that's why we believe that the pilots legitimately have separate collective bargaining agreements that govern their employment. If you're trained to fly on one type of plane, you're not going to pick up and fly the other type of plane.
At least the passengers hope so.
At least the passengers hope so, exactly. Well, all of this evidence is undisputed and on the record that day in and day out, it was Mr. Cuff's job to handle all United Express operations. Applying these facts, we believe and argue that Judge Leinenweber got it right, that Mr. Cuff's employment is exactly the type of joint employer contemplated under 29 CFR 825.106A. Here we have the benefit of a Department of Labor regulation that is exactly on point as to joint employment. There was an agreement to share his services. The employers acted in the interest of the others in relation to Mr. Cuff, and they were not completely disassociated. They shared control of him, and they're under common control. Under the regulations, if you were to solely base the decision upon the DOL regulations, any one of these factors would be dispositive of a joint employment relationship. We believe we have all of those factors here. And finally, as a practical matter, these are simply not the types of defendants that the FMLA's small employer exemption was designed to protect. The court in Moldenhauer actually went into that analysis and noted that one of the employers in that case only had 15 employees. These are major national airlines with thousands of employees nationwide. The whole theory that Mr. Cuff only worked for TSA actually came about when he requested FMLA leave in the last instance, because remember, he had already taken FMLA leave before and it had been granted without a problem. That's the first time there's anything in the record that anyone is telling him that he is solely an employee of TSA. And Mr. Basham, again, admitted in his deposition that the only piece of evidence that supports their determination that he was only an employee of TSA is that TSA cut his paycheck. But other than TSA cutting his paycheck, his day-to-day duties and who he reported to all were for both TSA and GoJet. And what's most ironic is that even after that determination is made, Mr. Cuff's own termination letter says that his employment with, quote, Transtates Holdings, end quote, is being terminated. So even his supervisor didn't buy this theory that he was solely an employee of Transtates Airlines. These undisputed facts should lead the court to affirm Judge Leinenweber on the issue of joint employment or on the alternative on the issue of integrated employment, but we don't believe you need to go there. The second issue was this issue of after-acquired evidence. First, I'll point out, as the court noted, there was no offer of proof that I recall on either of these issues when we were arguing the motions in limine. And more specifically, as to all three, there's no evidence that Mr. Cuff would have been fired for any of this conduct, that any other employee had been fired for this conduct, or that there were even written policies prohibiting the conduct. There was only counsel's argument at the motion in limine hearing, and that's just not enough. Moreover, the defendants failed to identify the date in which they became aware of these facts. And so, as you're aware, the jury did not, for whatever reason, award full back pay. And it could very well be that the date that they discovered these facts post-dated the cutoff of the jury award. We don't know, so frankly, the whole issue could be moot. With regard to the prescription drugs, there was, if I look at the record, no evidence of abuse. What the doctor said was that Mr. Cuff would occasionally self-medicate. He was dealing with Crohn's as well as bipolar. It's a condition that causes severe pain, the Crohn's does, and that sometimes he would take more pills than were prescribed, and sometimes he would take less pills than were prescribed. And the defendants knew that. If you look at the Record on Appeal 128-1, page 4, the defendants' own Rule 26 disclosures shows that they had received a note, a doctor's note, supporting a previous FMLA leave, specifically saying that Darren Cuff was taking hydrocodone and also that he was not always compliant with the doctor's instructions. They never tested him when he had returned from previous FMLA leaves. And the FAA regulations allow the use of prescription pain medication. With regard to the arrest, again, this is highly prejudicial evidence. He was never even charged. He was arrested and immediately released. And it would also violate the Illinois Human Rights Act to have terminated Mr. Cuff's employment based upon an arrest alone. And frankly, that's all we have here is an arrest. So we believe that Judge Leinenweber did not abuse his discretion in excluding that evidence. And finally, with regard to the sexual encounter, which in the reply brief has been turned into a truthfulness issue, Judge Leinenweber never barred defendants from arguing that Mr. Cuff had not been truthful in the course of an investigation. If you look at the transcript, again, from that motion in limine hearing, he only barred them from discussing Mr. Cuff's sexual history. And that sexual history is that he had had a one-time consensual encounter prior to his employment with the defendants, with somebody who ultimately became one of his subordinates. And again, turning to Mr. Basham's deposition, he admits that there's no company policy against consensual encounters, and he even said, quote, more power to them. Defendants chose not to address these after-acquired evidence issues in their reply brief. For these reasons, the district court, Judge Leinenweber, did not abuse his discretion, and we ask that issues on after-acquired evidence also be affirmed. Finally, turning to the fee issue, again, there is no evidence that Judge Leinenweber applied the wrong standard as set out by this court, or that he abused his discretion as to the factual issues underlying the fee award. There are three arguments made here: that the voluntary dismissal of the FMLA retaliation claim should lead to a reduction, the second issue is proportionality, and the third issue is whether fees should have been, or whether fees were improperly awarded for clerical work. On the voluntary dismissal, this court and the Supreme Court have both held that so long as there's a common core of facts, attorney's fees should not be parsed out on a dismissed claim. And again, there's no reason to change that longstanding precedent. The FMLA retaliation claim, in our opinion, by the time we had reached trial, was redundant. The damages were the same types of damages that were available under the FMLA interference claim. It would have just taken up more time at trial and possibly confused the jury to have two sets of instructions. On the proportionality issue, the same applies. Under Anderson and the State of Enoch, this court held that so long as damages are more than nominal, fees should not be reduced, even if the jury did not award 100% of the damages sought, and even if the fees exceeded the jury award. As you can see from Mr. Hayes, the defendants mounted a spirited defense, and they have the right to do that. And if a defendant chooses to mount a spirited defense, it cannot later complain that the attorney's fees that are being requested by the plaintiff are too high or out of proportion. Finally, on non-attorney work, Judge Leinenweber looked at this issue and indicated, and there's no indication that he abused his discretion as to the fee award. The type of work that's being complained about here is more than ministerial work. It involved preparing exhibit binders, proofreading, editing. These are substantive types of jobs that can be performed by paralegals and properly billed. It's not, for example, filing or stapling or running errands. Unless the court has any questions at this time, I have nothing further. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Hayes?
Nothing, Your Honor. Honors may more appropriate than what Mr. Caffarelli just said, because the factual disputes just keep pouring out. He represented to this court that Transstates and GoJet is all of United Express at O'Hare, and that isn't true. There are 12 separate companies. Only two of them have anything to do with Transstates Holdings. Republic Airways, Shuttle Airways, SkyWest, they all paint their airplanes the same. These are some of the factual disputes that we're talking about that we think need to be fully fleshed out. Simply the fact that both GoJet and Transstates...
Factual dispute.
Well, that same line, Your Honor, permeated this case that, oh, they're all just one big company. Just because it looks that way to the public, it's designed to look that way.
What is the factual dispute, the material factual dispute? The plaintiff is not claiming that he performed any services for anybody other than TSA, its holding company, or GoJet. And none of them has been held liable. So I don't see what the material dispute of fact is that you're trying to illuminate.
Well, for example, Your Honor, that Mr. Cuff was somehow the ultimate representative to the Department of Homeland Security. That's based on him saying that. I mean, my time has expired, Your Honor, but...
Thank you, counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.